Harsha, how you doing today, my man?
I'm doing great. Truly great. And yourself?
Also excellent. This one's gonna be fun. I gotta be honest, there's sometimes I know the people I'm talking to because I've seen them on the timeline a while. Not only is your topic I'm super green at when it comes to Bitcoin compliance and what we're gonna dive into, but actually besides your pretty legendary Twitter bio, you've done some dope shit, and your PFP that I see with like kind of the sideways hat, I don't know much about you almost at all. So I'd love to start by just kind of like a brief overview of some of your background and how you got into the Bitcoin space.
Yeah, dude, totally. So I used to be Anon for a while, right? Which is why, like, a lot of my shit just doesn't exist, right? I've been trying to change that and really kind of embrace my online like identity. So like I have like a real website now that's, exactly my kind of vibe. It's arsh.bot, very simple. I got into Bitcoin in like 2014, 2015, just kind of like buying things online. And I kind of asked myself at one point, why does a string of things result in like value being sent from this iPhone app to that thing over there? And yeah, that was like a rabbit hole. It turns out it's really cool why it happens. And I spent some time just kind of like really digging into how wallets work. And from there, well, I needed a job because I was a college student, needed internship money. So I got a job at like some companies here in Atlanta. And yeah, from there it's been just kind of a journey. So I worked at BitPay on a bunch of stuff, actually. I was responsible for spinning up like the SegWit like 2x testnet. Like it just had, we had like 100 Raspberry Pis all with USB miners like attached to it and just mining away. That was kind of cool. I didn't really know anything about politics and the block size wars. I knew everything technically about it, but like from a politics standpoint, I just didn't have really any opinions. From there, like BitPay was really cool, but after that, I started doing like a lot of contracting, got really into like a lot of random projects, like helped build like a block explorer called blockexplorer.com. I think it's now defunct. Got really into like, mining operations as well, and eventually met some really cool folks who were booting up Fold again. And so we booted up Fold. I was one of the founding engineers when Fold came back alive sometime in like 2018. And yeah, like rode Fold, helped build all their payment infrastructure for a long time, which is awesome. Ship Lightning, helped ship Bitcoin, a couple other things as well. And yeah, and from there it's just been kind of a journey. Worked at some other places as well and some really cool projects. Contributed to LND. I just want to see a ton of different projects like online. I just got really into like, contributing open source. There was one, I've only ever worked one non-Bitcoin job, and that was in like the streaming industry. Like that was the only time I didn't work in Bitcoin, and it was like as a recommendations engineer. It was pretty goofy. Yeah, I've been all over the place. Lightning Labs and Voltage and oh, where else? A couple other places. Oh, Swan. Yeah, a couple other places. Yeah,
Sweet.
I've been Bitcoin career my whole life.
That's cool, man. I mean, saying I've only worked one other job besides in the Bitcoin space is kind of a dope flex. So that's cool. And just to make sure, your background is heavily in kind of like the engineering tech side.
Yep, engineering protocol dev side. It yeah, if you guys go to my website, there's like no JavaScript and barely any CSS. Like I'm not a front end engineer at all. I like working on the hard problems.
Got it. Very cool. And then eventually you jumped into this thing called Magnolia. And I think a good chunk of this will be kind of in the high level, what is compliance and like the like banging your head against it, what does this mean for founders? But I wanted to get a context of like what you're currently building. So as it kind of like fits, we can jump in and double click on your company. So yeah, what is this building blocks thing you're building with Magnolia?
So if you're someone in the industry, you'll resonate with what I'm about to talk about, right? Like throughout my entire time in the industry, especially at Fold and Swan, there's always been like the boogeyman in the background of what are we legally allowed to do and how do we legally do it, right? And that's always felt like these big cement walls that dictate our entire product roadmap, and invisible lawyers always say no, and someone online stokes fear, and you just can never actually deliver what it is you as an engineer want to deliver to your end users. That's always just been the case, status quo. And it got to a point, like while I was at Swan, where I just kind of had enough with that mentality, right? Like Swan had been in this position where they were just flipping between these custodians, and it was just complete madness, right? Not only madness for the end users, right, who are just getting like are my coins safe or not, right? Like that anxiety, but also just madness for the Swan team as well, because you've got this entire incredibly talented engineering team that's just solely focused on keeping the lights on and making sure that the custodian is going to like operate effectively, right? So that's a situation where not only are you boxed in by the regulations and general anxiety of like, you know, legal side of things, but the people that you rely on to take care of that kind of stuff, you can't really rely on them either, right? And so it's like very specifically what I'm referring to is interacting with the fiat rail system and interacting with Bitcoin in a manner that is, you know, kosher by the US government. That's specifically what I'm referring to. There's a blanket word called compliance on this, right? And that just means like complying to the laws that in effect. And over the last 4 years, that's been completely BS because there have been no laws. So we've all been just trying to guess what the laws could be, you know, because the SEC has just been enforcing these laws without any actual precedent, and them enforcing the laws becomes a precedent. It's been just complete madness for the last 4 years, right? And so not only is there just a complete lack of clarity on what these laws could be, there's just been also no one who could really help guide anyone in the mid to small tiered area through this lack of clarity. So it's just been, yeah. So it started really Magnolia to solve that problem because everyone suffers from it.
Sounds like a huge problem. It's also one of the things that's, it really hurts innovation and it really hurts, it becomes like a centralizing force because the small man can't afford it unless he has like someone in their corner. I want to make sure I understand the pieces here though, because like I see there's like the regulatory uncertainty or like lack of clarity. And that's already like, you know, this morning Coinbase announced something with CBTC and like Morpho, this lending product. And it started up a mini debate in some circles of like, is it a taxable event? Does that make the product DOA? And some of us, and I'm kind of in this camp currently, but I'm also a noob, so good that you're here. It's like, it's not a taxable event, but you got to fight it and kind of plead your case. Others think it definitely is. So that's like the regulatory side. And then the other side, I'm not sure what the other part you're saying is. What is this kind of like tech and like team building thing you're mentioning? I don't fully grasp that one.
So the actual core services that we're referring to here are like on-ramping. So interacting with like fiat funds in any way, shape or form, like custody so that the business itself, the Bitcoin business can interact with Bitcoin. Actually, most people are not compliant in this way, but if you are going to interact with Bitcoin, you actually need to have licenses to do that. Most people don't do that. It's not well enforced because it's a state level problem, not a federal level problem. This kind of licensure is enforced at the state. So certain states really care a lot, like New York and California, which is why you really often, including with the Coinbase announcement, see that this excludes New York, right? But a lot of other states don't really care that much. And they have much lower barriers to entry. This is called MTL licensing, right? So anyway, on-ramping, custody, and then brokerage to actually facilitate the fiat to the custody side. That's just converting between fiat and Bitcoin.
I see. Okay. And you said MTL. I think that means money transmitter license.
That's exactly right.
And then is there MSB is the other one I hear floated around a lot?
Yeah, so MSB is the federal license, but it's a very low bar to achieve. The form is like 2 pages. It's not too crazy. That's really just registering with FinCEN, basically saying like, hey, I exist, you know, like I'm going to comply in these ways.
Okay. Then yeah, before we dive in the weeds, you've touched on it, but I want to put a nice frame around this idea of the term compliance. Mm-hmm. So we can kind of unpack it. So like when people say compliance in the realm of Bitcoin, what is kind of in that domain?
They basically want to make sure that whatever rails they're interacting with are kosher by the government. That's specifically it, right? When you interact with fiat in the US, it's by definition compliant and you kind of have the expectation going in. But Bitcoin kind of escapes that rail system, right? And generally crypto does too. And so there's a lot of it that is not compliant that you can still perform. It's just that lots of institutions don't want to interact with those systems that are not compliant. And so all the systems that we've got that we're building up, there is an air of compliance on all of it, but we're not really building it to be compliant. We're building it because people need the tools. The tools just are also completely legally regulated. And also our ethos aligned, but the tools are what people really need. Mm-hmm. Compliance is just the flavor.
Okay, so compliance is anything that's you know, kosher by the government standards. It's legal and regulated according to all the laws that are currently applied. It only applies when we talk about it mainly because the U.S. is such a broad market. We're mainly talking about the U.S. International, it changes drastically, I'm assuming.
Yeah, depending on the jurisdiction, right? So Europe just released like, or a lot of really very large framework just went into effect in Europe called MiCA, and that's like mm-hmm. a whole thing and a half. So that's a different set of rules too.
Got it. And so the U.S. has kind of like been tricky because they've been enforcing it through like legal action and not giving us clarity. MiCA sounds like the current best standard for at least it's clear, even though people can fight about what the rules are. And that's like kind of like the best we have as far as you pass or fail.
Yes, exactly. But from the U.S. like business point of view, we just don't really know until we see other companies go through the gauntlet. Because in the U.S., we're a little bit shell-shocked, to be honest with you. We don't trust the new regulations and new frameworks until someone goes through it, because you just don't know anymore, right? Like, and you know, Silvergate was a very well-regulated bank, right? That was like federally chartered, or it was chartered. I actually don't remember if it was federally chartered. I assume it was. But then, you know, the SEC forced them to shut down and then gagging them from talking about it, right? So like complying in the U.S. doesn't mean you're all clear.
Got it. Got it. And how does this change with being entitied here, like you have a Delaware C Corp versus you're outside of that, but you serve U.S. customers? Because that's one thing I've seen is like you domicile somewhere else, but if you serve U.S. customers, as soon as you start to do that, you're kind of on the hook, it seems like. So people geo-block. What's the interplay here?
So in the U.S., like we're U.S. based for a couple different reasons. It doesn't really matter actually where it is you're based necessarily. It matters what customers you interact with, right? So Polymarket, for example, they don't have any licenses to operate in the U.S. And so as a result, they try to like block people from interacting with them as much as possible. Right? And they do a pretty good job of it. But they can be based in the U.S. They can be based not in the U.S. in Panama. It doesn't really matter though. You know what I mean? Because they just don't have the licenses to interact with U.S. customers. That's the important.
Yep. Got it. Okay. Cool, man. And we've touched on a bunch of topics. What do you think, from your point of view, what is like the biggest headaches or like, I'm not sure the best way to word it. If you could like get clarity on one topic, what's the biggest one messing founders up right now?
Man, honestly, so much. Like just like the entire conversation, you know, like from top to bottom. Because like, you know, like all these different like regulatory bodies, they put out like different guidelines or briefs that are like completely at odds with each other. Like the IRS document that we were talking about on Twitter, that one is incredible, truly incredible, like a masterpiece, really, and just messing up our entire industry. Because they go through and they're like, so our friends over at FinCEN said this, that's horseshit. Our friends over the SEC said this, we don't believe in that. No, they just like go through and just said all this precedent that we built up. No, we're going to do it like this. In fact, we're going to do it like this in a way that the names that we're associating don't even make sense. And we just don't care. Like, for example, they called front-end like apps, dApps. They're considering them brokers, not because they act like brokers, but because they're the most convenient party in this whole system to treat as a broker. It's like, okay, this is very difficult to deal with, right, as an industry. That's like one example, right? Another example is like, we've all dealt with debanking. It's hard to get a bank account in Bitcoin or crypto, even a little bit. From an operational point of view, I mean, starting Magnolia, we had to go to two or three different banks. Right? That's just the way it is right now. But getting your Bitcoin business to actually interact with folks with just a credit card, that is so difficult. And the assumption right now is you don't do that. You can't do it. It's very difficult to do that. Don't worry about it. So your addressable market is already pigeonholed, right? So if this is Bitcoin we're talking about, which is massive, what if it's something not Bitcoin? What if it's a layer two on Bitcoin? What if it's Lightning? What if it's, you know, like something built on Strata or some other new thing? You've just got this incredibly frictionful product journey that you don't even control before people can even get to your business. Don't do that. You know, like that's one of the reasons why we're building like what we're building, because that doesn't need to be like that. You know, we can make this a lot better. We can make this a lot easier.
Yeah. Basically, it sounds like everything sucks right now. It's hella hard to be a startup founder and be, you know, not have to have in the back of your head that I might get a wealth notice or some kind of notice in my mail and be totally screwed.
Like Pumped Up Fun, right? Like great example, you know, just took off out of nowhere, right? I did really well. You know, like I applaud the team's ability to keep the lights on, but that much attention is just so much. And when you're a small little startup, you don't have the budget for a big old compliance department. You don't have the budget for really well-seasoned lawyers. You're probably doing something that hasn't been done before. Have that many eyes on that like startup so quickly, it's like, wow, that company's probably going to die. You know, like
it's funny because like saying the quiet thing out loud is probably something like the average founder goes a little more risk on when they're small because they assume they're a small fish and will go under the radar. And once they hit sufficient size, then they'll pay and they'll fix it and, you know, when it's needed. If you pumped off on it, you're screwed. Like, it's too big, too fast.
It's true.
Sorry. But it does seem like a lot of people just, like, they do what they can. They pay their lawyer. Hopefully, their lawyer's competent. But at some point, they got to kind of YOLO or you don't build anything.
That's the situation most people are in this space, to be honest. And then it sucks because it's so cyclical, because then regulators look at something like pump.fun and they're like, oh man, the rest
that's
of y'all
scapegoat,
like right? Like, I cannot tell you how often on calls with regulators or like lawyers, they're like, well, I'm glad you guys are like Bitcoin first or Bitcoin only, you know, like as long as you guys aren't like FTX. Gosh, dude, you know, like the damage that happens when people, because remember, people forget this about FTX. FTX was only operational for a year. They got really big, really
fast.
That's
crazy.
Right? Like, it was very, very fast, right? Same situation.
Yep. Interesting. So then what is, like, you're a founder. We don't want to be all doom and gloom. Like, we're trying to still push Bitcoin forward. So, like, it sounds like the two, I guess, like, what are the paths? Like, you could use someone like Magnolia who can kind of like abstract away some of the complexity. But like, what is the yellow brick road here? Or like the potential decision trees if you're a founder trying to be compliant, but not go insane?
So two different answers for two different, like, you know, basically personalities that I have, right? One is like the answer that I give for Magnolia, like as Magnolia's founder, and the other I'm going to give is like a Bitcoiner, right? So here's a Bitcoiner answer. The Bitcoiner answer is, even though I hate like regulation, not all regulation is bad, you know, because right now this industry needs protections from these just overzealous bureaucracies with people who are just, you know, executing their own agenda that has nothing to do with the elected people. We need protections against people like that, right? Like, the government is way bigger than any single entity. There's, you know, like what, 400 or 500 different like bureaucracies. Some of them are on the side of good, and we need those to police the ones that are not, right? And that's why I'm really, really excited for like any legislation that comes up before 2026, because ideally they will like kind of codify from an elected body what we are allowed to do and what we're not allowed to do. And that is just the kind of clarity that we need. So I'm really excited for that, because this no clarity thing has been terrible. And then in the meantime, and even afterwards, right? Because all these like small startups and medium-sized startups are still not going to be able to comply, because like things like KYC AML are not going away. Things like state-by-state money transmitter licenses are not going to go away. And that could cost like just a lot of capital. None of that's going to go away. Companies like Magnolia that provide the licenses and the infrastructure in a way that's still non-custodial, that is what people need to rely on and like actually use to propel their business and be able to say with a clear mind, like, okay, I'm not at risk. Our company is completely compliant. You know, we're not like, we're above board. We're one of the good ones.
That's good. You mentioned non-custodial towards the end there. And I remember that was one that came up recently with, was it Potato Cash or Samurai? One of those ones where like they got caught and it became this big thing of like the FinCEN rules from 2019 were called into question, because if you don't control the keys or if you don't really move the money, you're not responsible, but now maybe you are. So, like, how much of a safe haven is custodial versus non-custodial and, like, the headache involved from there?
So, that's a great question, by the way. So, non-custodial means different things to different people, right? Like, to Bitcoiners, it means, like, you know, it's not your keys, not your coin. No one can take my keys, right? But to infrastructure providers, right, like myself, and even to anyone who does KYC AML, the value of your infrastructure isn't in, can I take someone's money? It's, can I prevent like this money from being moved, right? That's all KYC AML is about. That's all about preventing money from moving to the benefit of like terrorists, right? That's OFAC compliance. And so you can still be a completely non-custodial entity, right? That doesn't have the ability to move someone's funds without their like say-so, while still being OFAC compliant and preventing like payments to political enemies of the US government, which, by the way, if you're in the US, you cannot do in the slightest. You know, it's not my rules, it's their rules, but you can't send money to terrorists. So that's how non-custodial and still not 100% control, like, kind of go hand in hand, right? This shows up all over the place in Bitcoin. It's just kind of a nuanced topic that people don't really fully understand, right? Like, a lot of non-custodial Lightning wallets, for example, have the same problem. They're non-custodial, but they all connect to the same node. The node can't take their money, but if that node charges really high fees, you're going to pay those fees on the way out, you know? And some developers, what they'll do is they'll define non-custodial as the ability to unilaterally exit. And that is something that we facilitate for sure. You can leave, you know, our systems completely by yourself, but then you're not like covered by any of the compliance stuff that we offer, right? So it's kind of like at your own risk, which is totally fine for a lot of people. And, you know, I respect it. Now, I said this, we use this word in a lot of different ways. And a lot of people use it in different ways. In the financial world, they actually have a word for this that kind of means the same thing, but it's called bankruptcy remoteness. It's not really non-custodial. What it means is the person who's interacting with, like, you know, the bank account or, you know, who's driving this thing, they don't have the ability to take funds in any legal way. This is really important if your entity goes bankrupt and creditors are trying to claw back as much cash as they possibly can, right? Someone is in custody of the thing, but if it's bankruptcy remote, even from the person who's in custody of it, it's isolated from those creditors, right? It's kind of funny. We all use different words for different things in Bitcoin and crypto and finance, turns out.
That's super interesting. So on the bankruptcy remoteness one, I can imagine it gives protection for the holder. It's kind of like more legal headache to get access to it. Trying to think about the person who is like the infrastructure provider or the broker. Does it give them, are you saying it gives them protection too by that same extension? Because it's, they can't access like it,
we're not legally touching this money. We are driving the APIs, but that money is not ours in any way, shape, or form, you know?
And that's
really important, you know? Because like, we don't really want to own this money because that's like a headache for ourselves too. You know, we don't want to be in a position where if someone like, you know, if like, God forbid, we go down, you know, we're just not going to be like viable anymore. We don't want our customers' money to potentially be like, you know, what's the word? Like reachable for our creditors. That's just not something we want. Our lenders, rather.
Got it.
And so it's a huge benefit to us, too.
I'm curious about if you want to lean into custodial. Because, like, huge topic. And it's going to evolve over time. Some people believe that, and I'm kind of in this camp, that, like, as regulations get crazier, it could go either way. It either gets really good and you can just file your stuff and custodial kind of becomes a path, or it gets so headache inducing to KYC and whatever that these other tools actually have better UX. Like UX is kind of like the friction point for adoption. So there's two kind of like narratives going and we're seeing how they play out. Assuming custodial gets easy enough and that's kind of like the frictionless easier way in for it, how should someone try and lean into that? Like they want to go client and they're going to deal with the headache as a founder. What should they know? They're on day one or they're a few months into the idea. Give us some of the map so they can not start at zero.
Yeah. So if you're going to do this yourself, honestly, what you should do is identify which states you want to like service first. Servicing all 50 states is going to be kind of difficult. It's going to be a lot. So don't even try to do that, right? Identify which states you want. Then what you want to do is there's this thing called NMLS. I can't remember what it stands for, but it's like the interface that like everyone uses for applications at a state like level. Most states are like use NMLS. And so that's like where you just track your application progress and stuff like that. That's where you apply for your money transmitter license. Now, within NMLS, there's something called MMLA. Right? MMLA is basically like a common application that you can send out to like 20 or so states that makes it relatively easy to apply to them, right? So that's like a really like relatively cheap way to apply to all these folks. Now, these are all lawyer fees, of course, right, that I'm talking about. So you don't have to have a massive compliance team, but you do have to have a compliance team. A lot of these states require the existence of a dedicated compliance officer. So you got to have one of those, which you're going to need anyway. But then the other thing you're going to have to figure out is there are something called surety bonds. Surety bonds are where the main cost comes from. Basically, it's an asset or cash or something else that you put up like in each of these states. Some states have a very low surety bond cost, like $10,000. Other states have a very high surety bond cost, like $1 million or two, depending on like how much volume you perform, right? So that's where a lot of this cost is. You're not really paying the state. You're putting it up, but you shouldn't expect to get that money back. You're kind of paying the state, like you're putting it into a bond. It's a whole thing. And yeah, like I said, every state has their own rules. Some states have really wacky formulas for to figure out how much their surety bonds cost should be. Other states have like, you know, what's the word? Like just a flat fee. But that's fine, right? Listen, you're a starting founder. You don't want to do all the things in the world, right? You want to do as much as you can. What you should do is find a competent lawyer to look at the specific laws for each of these states and figure out which states you are technically exempt from, right? Then send a no action letter to those states. That'll get you at least a couple of states for free. And typically the no action letter doesn't go contested. If it does, sorry, you're probably going to be in that state. You got a license in the state. But so that's like my quick little toolbox, you know, of how to get licensed quick and relatively cheap, you know?
That is some serious, serious game you just dropped. So yeah, it definitely sounds like KYC, AML, that's par for the course. You need to find a provider for that, most likely.
Not only just a provider, you need to find, you probably have to go with someone that the banks like, which might invoke a couple names that you don't like. Try and find someone that they're happy with that isn't them, but you have to have someone, right? We actually use like Amboss for Lightning, which great people, great friends. Mm-hmm. They don't do KYC, they just do AML stuff.
And just so I'm clear, is the disconnect there that the corporate bank you're using is going to require you to have those protections, or they won't bank you, or is that's the connection?
They won't bank you. Like, the regulators aren't going to grant you a license. You need to have an AML KYC policy drafted up. That policy needs to be like third party reviewed. It's actually called an AML CFT policy, combating financial terrorism, something like that. That's specifically a policy you need. No one will work with you without an AML policy. Anti-money laundering is taken so seriously in this country. It is wild.
Got it. Okay. We dropped all the acronyms, but I wrote them down, so they'll be in the description, people. You can plug them in later. The government
loves its acronyms.
100%. Yeah, this is crazy SpaghettiOs. But okay, this is very cool. Let's pivot then a little bit into the stuff we were talking about on Twitter with bridging assets, what is a taxable event, and like, just to preface a little for people, the thing that kicked it off was Coinbase, which launched CBTC 6 months ago, 5 months ago, and is like skyrocketing the TVL. They're killing it as far as that metric. They're launching products that support it. So the big one today is Morpho, this like Bitcoin-backed lending protocol. It looks pretty cool. Lending rates are decent, and it kind of blends TradFi and protocols. So like, you log in on Coinbase, you can touch into Morpho. That's all cool. But then the question becomes like, is bridging into CBTC a taxable event? And then it kind of becomes a wash to even take a loan if you're going to take a haircut, was like how it started. And that led to, is Lightning a taxable event? What is and isn't? There's a bunch here, and you know more than me, so I'd love for you to like kind of guide what makes sense here. But yeah, is like, give us some color.
The answer is, we're not entirely sure, right? Like, that's the genuine answer. That's typically the answer when it comes to stuff, right? So here's why people think it is a taxable event, right? People think it's a taxable event because the IRS, like IRS recently put out a new document pretty much saying that they are trying to enforce like taxation rules at DEXs, and they care a lot about this. Here's how they're going to go about it, right? In like crypto land, specifically DEXs, there are a lot of ways that people have like come up with to make it really difficult for the IRS to basically figure out who is trading what. And so what the IRS has done is they put together a framework that breaks all of the previous the constraints, expectations we've had, and they're treating anyone who interacts with the transaction, specifically crafts the transaction, to be a broker. Anyway, this is all getting into who is responsible for like submitting a 1099-DA, which is how the IRS figures out if this thing is taxable or not, right? This all signals like pretty heavily that the IRS is pretty interested in taxing anything that converts from one asset to the other. And the language that they used is like a little bit vague, which is why this applies to way more than just DEXs. It applies to bridges. It applies to like, you know, a lot of like things in Bitcoin land as well. It can apply to like Lightning bridges too. If a decentralized thing is doing something from asset A and turns into asset B, IRS probably wants to cut. That's really annoying. Really annoying. Now, that specific like guideline they put out is getting sued right now. They might drop it in the next like administration. We just don't know. We don't know how the lawsuit's going to go. It's going to take 2 years until it's actually going to be enforced. So there's a lot of time. That's why people think this thing ought to be taxed. That's like a lot of context here. People think that this won't be taxed because this is not a bridge that we're talking about. We're talking about a loan. Like, so, you know, even though Bitcoin is leaving your custody and a stablecoin is entering your custody, it's a little bit more nuanced than that. This isn't a conversion. You know, you're not selling it. Even though when you look at it, you know, like you're seeing the USD value of Bitcoin in a stable coin, right? It's just the Bitcoin's being collateralized. More things are happening in the background. But when you look at this with dimly lit glasses or whatever the, you know, thing is, this looks like a conversion, right? That's why people all still, like, that's the mindset of why people think that this is going to be a tax setup, right? Now, what we're talking about is we're trying to figure out what the letter of the law means or says. First off, it's not clear. Second off, I think people in like broader like crypto and Bitcoin don't understand this. The government is savvy when it comes to this stuff. They have caught up. They are not leaving crypto alone. Like they've been waging a war at the institutional level for like almost 4 years, or rather 2 years. It feels like 4 years. If the letter of the law doesn't say this, these bureaucracies, they can just put out a new guideline that says they're going to tax a specific thing. And that seems to be the direction that they want to go in. The only thing really changing that is going to be this new administration. And if they have a much softer opinion on like on crypto as a whole and they want to see crypto like fly, that's the only thing that's going to stop them. You know? These are not laws that are hard to pass. They don't pass. They're bureaucracies. These bureaucracies don't interact with each other either. The IRS document, they just threw out all the, you know, things that FinCEN said and the SEC said. So, like, I don't think people understand just how little you should care about things that are not going to be in effect just yet, while also understanding that just because it doesn't say one thing today doesn't mean someone's going to come out, like, someone can't come out in 6 months and just say something totally different. Like, that's coming back to the protections. Why we need protections? Because that's just the way that's the world we live in right now.
Yeah. And to make sure I'm clear on how these words land, when you say guideline versus like a law, these are separate things, right? Like a guideline is like bumpers on a bowling lane. It's not like something super crazy or like definitive, but it will get called into question if you're trying to set precedent at the court case. Like what's the dance here of guideline versus law?
No, you got it. You got it entirely. So there are no laws for crypto. There are no laws. No one's elected representative has come out on it with anything that says this is what it should look like or shouldn't look like. So what these bureaucracies have been doing is they've been issuing like guidelines or basically fancy blog pieces that pretty much say like, here's how you should behave. And this is going to be the law kind of until we get like actual something from Congress, like an actual bill from Congress. The thing about this system is that those things are really lossy. It's really all about who cares about what. Like, this is exclusively a politics game, right? Like, 100%. The FinCEN 2019 thing, if you read it, it reads exactly like how a BitGo lawyer would make this read. Like, it's pretty clear that BitGo, like, just lobbied for that in there, which is, like, awesome, great. Like, we benefited for a while, you know? But, like, that's just the way how things are right now. That's the way it's going to be until laws get in place. And when those laws get in place, what, like, it's not going to be clear, like, clear cut protections. We're going to have to see who actually got the protections. You know, is it all of us? It's not going to be all of us. So who paid the most? Who, like, you know, greased the right wheels? This is, I think everyone understands, like, laws when it comes to, like, traffic tickets and building codes, things that individuals have to deal with on the daily basis, millions, if not billions of times per year, trillions of times. What we're talking about right now is stuff that's never happened, only happens rarely, right, from the regulatory perspective, and has no precedence for. The only way that that kind of, like, regulatory environment gets figured out is by people, like, just lobbying the right people. That's how this works. If you don't like it, I'm with you. I hate it too. But this is how this system has always worked in the U.S. It's just that everyday people are not really privy to a completely brand new regulatory environment. That's just not something most people interact
with. Yeah, that makes sense. On this topic, like this gray area topic keeps bugging me. And it's like one that popped up on the timeline when we're in some of these chats is like the wrapped ETH versus ETH debate. And so to me, this brought up this question of like the way that companies need to move because you're offering a service and maybe your VC, there's a bunch of reasons you don't want to get debanked. You have to act differently than the individual who might fight the IRS because and say these 17 things are transfers, not exchange, like that thing. So like, do we have any examples? Because it seems like we don't find out till it's like a lawsuit with like Samurai, Tornado Cash, or like an exchange. Do we have any examples of like a person fighting the IRS for like a wrapped ETH case and winning? Or like, Because that's the one that would be curious to me.
No. No. So, like, what, like, how the SEC and other regulatory, like enforcement agencies operate is they make examples out of people. And that's been their, like, modus operandi for a little bit. So they're not going to go after, like, little known people who can't defend themselves because there's a good chance of that case getting tossed, right? Or rather that, like, precedent not being set. What they do is they go after a well-known entity with really good lawyers, and they come at them with the best they got, right? That's actually like, there's a lesson. I got this lesson from a mentor of mine because, you know, we're obviously super deep in compliance space. I am someone who is willing to fight, believe deeply in, like, you know, individual rights and stuff. And that's my entire, like, you know, work in Bitcoin reflects that. But he told me, like, listen, if that day ever comes, you don't hire the best lawyers. Don't even hire the second best lawyers. If it's a name brand law firm, do not hire them, right? Hire someone who's middle of the pack, because if you do and you lose, like, the industry isn't completely destroyed because it wasn't the best law firm, you know, like, there's a chance of this, like, precedent not holding up, you know? And that's just a wild conversation to have with someone. But, like, listen, if you're going down, just make sure you don't take us all down with you.
The brand name speaks. Like, how could you take down the Tether or the whatever it is? Damn, that's a ninja move. That's smart. Man, we ran through most of my questions pretty quickly. We covered a lot, so this has been action-packed for the 40 minutes. The only two questions I got left, and then we can just open up to, like, anything that you find interesting or that I didn't ask that is relevant. Does this change at all with stablecoins or not really? Like, I'm assuming it's just the same kind of KYC AML, but, like, has anything changed with stables?
No. KYC, like, all the compliance stuff is just the same, right? The thing is, the U.S. government is deeply interested in stablecoins, right? Like, so I was at a policy summit in Dallas a couple months back, and some wild folks were there. Like, Paul Ryan was there and a bunch of, like, other senators and stuff. And it seems like, overwhelmingly, they're all pro-Bitcoin, right? But overwhelmingly, they are deeply interested in stablecoins as a way of projecting our national, like, economy and our national, like, you know, strength. In a way that competes with China in places like Africa and even South America without necessarily depleting the US dollars, like, reserves in America. So, like, this is a way to expand our global outreach without so much direct involvement, right? Because, well, it's not the US government doing this. It's other companies doing this on behalf of the US government, right? And all the money kind of stays over here while the stablecoins go over there, right? Which is kind of a fascinating take. I didn't really expect stablecoins to get pulled into like the national like defense conversation, but a lot of people have it like that. Like that is their viewpoint here. And if you're someone who doesn't want to see, like, blockchain co-opted by a national government, or doesn't want to see Bitcoin co-opted by any government, listen, I understand fully. I deeply empathize, but here's the thing about double-edged swords, you know? Your weapon is also their weapon. You gotta embrace that.
Yep. Okay. Well, the last question I got is, you think about this a lot. So, like, what would you change, or what would be your suggestions? Like, I can't quite tell if it's like some people are just kind of like, fingers crossed, let the regulators do their bullshit and we're going to respond in kind and be compliant, versus like, what does sane regulation look like? Like, what are some of the suggestions that people bring forward that make sense?
So this will never happen, by the way, right? That I want. This will never happen. But instead of, like, 50 state licenses to do this stuff, if it could be one federal license, that would make life really easy for everyone, right? Now, you could argue that's technically already the case. That federal license is called a bank charter. And I hear you, but I don't really want to be burdened by 200, 300 years of banking law, you know?
Mm.
That's a ridiculous burden on any business. There needs to be something that works for the mom and pops of crypto, as well as the Coinbase crypto. You know, there needs to be. That would be my one thing. It's not going to happen, not because banking law exists or anything like this, but because states have the rights to regulate, like, financial things within their borders. That's why MTLs exist. State banks are also a thing. You just never interact with them, and oftentimes they're not entirely, like, FDIC compliant or FDIC insured, but they do exist. You know, yeah. So, and that would be my wish list item.
Got it. Yeah. And going back to double-edged swords, like, I can totally see it makes it way easier to build, but then, you know, kind of the narrative of the make the government as small as efficiently possible, like, that's given them a very blunt instrument to be a source of, like, all the lobbying. You just point at that thing, and that's the thing you look at.
It also, instead of being beholden to 50 different regulatory bodies, which sounds bad, but is actually great because most of them are underfunded, you are beholden to one regulatory body that switches every couple of years, you know?
Yep.
And that's not fun.
Good point. Good point. Yeah.
Yeah. So very much a double-edged sword.
Got it. Okay. Well, we covered a shit ton. This has been great. You're super deep in the space. Anything you want to close with or topics you want to touch on that you think the either founder should know or compliance nerds would find interesting?
Oh, man. I mean, I've got so much stuff to say. I mean, the thing is, like, at the end of the day, like, even though, like, we've only talked about compliance in this conversation, this is, I'm still trying to, like, work out this narrative, but I care deeply about, like, you know, the Cypherpunk Manifesto. I care deeply about people's privacy, and I care deeply about making sure that anyone can interact with, like, you know, a monetary value source that is not related to any political, like, currency. I care deeply about all of these ethos values. And you see someone like me who's, you know, contributed to Bitcoin in all these ways, getting involved at, like, the compliance level. And, you know, you wonder, why? Why am I doing this? And the real answer is, in order for people who don't have my values to interact with Bitcoin, they've got to have, like, conversion points that effectively bring Bitcoin into TradFi or TradFi into Bitcoin. Right now, all those, like, conversion points, which we call in the industry on-ramps or off-ramps, they are just completely rotted through. And as a result, people in TradFi land can't interact with Bitcoin the way they want to. People in Bitcoin can't interact with TradFi the way they want to. And we all suffer. The road is, like, you know, bleak at times, but truthfully, things are getting better. Right. The more we do, the more business we perform, the more people pay attention. That's always been the case. It all started with the pizza transaction, you know, forever ago. Right. And look where we are now. We've got, like, a huge financial like landscape to build on. Wish I could do the same thing. Like, could not be more bullish on Bitcoin, even though all I do is focus on Bitcoin's problems. But that's why I focus on Bitcoin's problems, because I couldn't be more bullish.
Heck yeah. We're thankful to you for it. Last side note question, because you started as an engineer, and it's always funny to me, people who, like, start deep in the weeds and they end up being, like, a CEO where you just kind of, like, vision and directing. And it seems like you went from, like, code guy to, like, reading checklists and reading documents and, like, sending emails guy. So, like, is that true? Like, how's that transition been, if that's the case?
Yeah, it is true. We actually had to, like, I had to, like, get a really good friend of mine to be the co-founder so he could be the CTO, so I can now focus on the CTO part, right? It's been a lot because I still deeply enjoy, like, programming, and I still, like, contribute every now and then. Like, some random project will just see a PR from me. It's just like,
nice.
That's just how I keep the dream alive, because I really do care about this. I just have the ability to set aside what I want to do with what I need to do, and I do it, you know? So I can get really deep into anything and make it super exciting to me, which is how, like, I turn compliance into a huge fight for our rights. That's what it is in my head.
That's what it feels like. It feels like when it's, like, passion meeting purpose, you're just, like, an unstoppable force that's just going to fuck shit up. So that's dope.
100%.
Cool, man. Well, I think that is the pod. Thank you so much for coming on, dude. It's been great.
It's been a blast, truly. Great questions, by the way. Awesome preparation. Yeah, I had a lot of fun.
Awesome. We'll have to do another round two in a year, hopefully when some good stuff has come through, and see how prescient this pod is.
I look forward to it. We'll have a lot to talk about in a year. This is about to be a crazy year for Bitcoin.
Thank you for listening this far into the episode. If you found it enjoyable, please do like, subscribe on whatever platform that you're listening on. YouTube does me a huge favor to like and subscribe. Find me on Twitter at Jake Blockchain. Show me some love. I reply to every DM. And if you are a Bitcoin builder that is kind of at the forefront of building new use cases, whether it's L1, Lightning, Stacks, Rootstock, Rollups, Ordinals, BRC20, I want to talk to you. So when I'm not doing this podcast, I am the sourcing partner at the Bitcoin Frontier Fund, where we invest in Bitcoin startups at the earliest stages, give you access to whatever you need, whether it's legal, product, fundraising help, as well as capital. So love to talk to you. You can hit me up again. Find me on Twitter at Jake Blockchain, and shoot me a DM. I'll read everything. Love to talk to you guys. Alright, peace. It's gone up. We playing the long game to the block rock chains with the racks paid off from the blockchain. Going up high octane, so we up in here like pomade. Making big noise, big money, go play with your kid toys. You funny, I'm counting my Bitcoin. We up and we been gone. It's gone up. Planned it out and we did this purposefully. Panning out like the kitchen currently. It's like surgery. Way it's earning me. A nurse's salary for cryptocurrency. I'm on a vacay drinking coconuts while wearing polka dots. This ain't no hocus pocus. Listen up and learn. It's gone up.